Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Talk with Tenny. It is another episode where we are going to be talking about all types of current, historical, and futuristic possibilities for what we can do as a society to solve the problems that we're up against and not consistently utilize forms of discrimination against people as a way to think that we've got a problem solved. Again, we're going to be talking about institutional oppression and the involuntary outpatient commitment laws, which exist all over the United States and other places in the world. Last night, Eric Fabris was on about his book, Tranquil Prisons, and talked about chemical incarceration as part of what's happening with community treatment orders and involuntary outpatient commitment laws. I want to give you the phone number if you want to call in. It's area code 267-521-0167. That's area code 267-521-0167. So for those of you who may not know about what the involuntary outpatient commitment laws are, I'm going to use New York as an example. I'm looking at the Office of Mental Health's webpage specific to this, and that can be found at www.omh.ny.gov /OMH web /Kendra_web/K-summary.htm. This was originally posted on November of 1999, and it was revised in May of 2006. And the title of this entry on the Office of Mental Health's website is An Explanation of Kendra's Law. So it states, in 1999, New York State enacted legislation that provides for assisted outpatient treatment for certain people with mental illness who, in view of their treatment history and present circumstances, are unlikely to survive safely in the community without supervision. This law is commonly referred to as Kendra's Law and is set forth in Section 9.60 of the Mental Hygiene Law. It was named after Kendra Webdow, a young woman who died in January of 1999 after being pushed in front of the New York City subway train by a person who was living in the community at the time but was not receiving treatment for his mental illness. In 2005, the law was renewed with several changes, which are noted in this article. I'd like to say that what happened to Kendra and any murder is a travesty and an obvious crime against humanity. And so I want you to understand that that's where I'm coming from. But the person who committed this atrocity and violation of life would not qualify for Kendra's Law. He repeatedly sought out psychiatric treatment and was repeatedly denied by psychiatry. And so we have to ask ourselves, what are we really doing here? So the Office of Mental Health's webpage goes on to give an overview of assisted outpatient treatment. One of the first things that happened was they changed the name from the Involuntary Outpatient Commitment Law to be called Assisted Outpatient Treatment to make it sound like it was better than it was, because when you start to tell the public that the state is going to have an involuntary outpatient commitment law for people that they deem unsafe to live in the community, the public gets concerned about that because the public realizes that this can apply to them in some way. And so every effort was made in order to make what involuntary outpatient commitment is, as described by many people, torture, as benevolent as it could possibly sound. And it's a veiled benevolence, and it's not, it doesn't really help people, although to be sure it does control them. So the overview that the New York State Office of Mental Health has of assisted outpatient treatment is Kendra's Law establishes a procedure for obtaining court orders for certain individuals with mental illness to receive and accept outpatient treatment. The prescribed treatment is set forth in a written treatment plan prepared by a physician who has examined the individual. The procedure involves a hearing in which all the evidence, including testimony from the physician, and if desired, from the person alleged to need treatment, is presented to the court. So I'd really, if this is sounding a little foreign to you and all of a sudden you're trying to figure out why a court is involved in somebody receiving some type of expressed medical treatment, why would there be a court and why would there be a person having an alleged need to treatment, and why would a physician be testifying in a court, and why would a judge ultimately be making medical decisions about this whole process? You know, we have to kind of start to ask ourselves. The number to call in if you're listening is 267-521-0167. So more back to the summary. So if the court determines that the individual meets the criteria for assisted outpatient treatment, AOT, an order is issued to the Director of Community Services, DCS, who oversees the mental health program of a locality, i.e., the county or the city of New York mental health director. The court orders will require the director to provide or arrange for those services described in the written treatment plan that the court finds necessary. The initial order is effective for up to 6 months and can be extended for successive periods of up to 1 year. Now, this is misinformation because the New York SAFE Act has altered this to some degree. So the petitioners, let's just jump down because the revised version is May 2006, and so they haven't really updated this yet, but hopefully they will. And that's one of the things we can get them to do. So the petitioners are an 18-year-old or older, an adult who is a roommate of the person, a parent, spouse, adult child, or adult sibling of the person, the director of a hospital where the person is hospitalized, the director of a public or charitable organization, agency, or a home that provides mental health services to the person or in whose institution the person resides, a qualified psychiatrist who is either treating the person or supervising the treatment of the person for mental illness, a licensed psychologist or licensed social worker who is treating the person for mental illness, the director of community services or social services official of the city or council where the person is present or is reasonably believed to be present, or a parole officer or probation officer assigned to supervise the person. And so those are all the different people that can bring you to court to take you in and put you on a petition for assisted outpatient treatment, which is involuntary outpatient commitment. The Office of Mental Health offers a variety of different forms and information about the ways in which one can access Kendra's Law, and they make the forms freely available on the internet. It's quite apparent that there's a lot of money that is involved behind all of this, and it's literally, millions of dollars a year, millions of taxpayer dollars a year that is causing this to happen. So if you have something to say about this, call in area code 267-521-0167. There is a new articles that are coming out on a daily basis about Kendra's Law and how it all winds up coming out together. So I'm just getting to the forms page of the Office of Mental Health, and there are different kinds of forms that can be used that you can download. So when we talk about the ability of this happening, of somebody being in the community and being considered a danger to somebody, self or somebody else, which means that you've been hospitalized twice in the last 36 months, or you've been considered a danger to yourself or somebody else in the last 4 years, and that you are considered that you will not be able to live unsupervised safely in the community. These are the essential components of what requires somebody to be involuntarily treated. The drugs. The drugs is very often the form of treatment in which people are getting. And so this becomes an issue because the drugs are, A, it's misleading. While some people report that they find benefit from it, and I think it's somewhere around a third of people who are on psychiatric drugs do find benefit from the drugs, two-thirds of people do not. And whether you're voluntarily or involuntarily taking these drugs, they definitely will have the same side effects, metabolic syndrome, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, kidney, liver problems, tardive dyskinesia, diabetes, especially with the atypicals, and heavy drugs, and then the drugging of children and how it's winding up happening earlier. But the involuntary outpatient commitment laws are a huge concern because they're looking right now in the United States to expand them on a national level. And they're actually even under the H.R. 3717, the Helping Families and Mental Health Care Crisis Act, the Murphy Bill. There's actually provisions in it that will act as financial incentives or punishments to states who do not have an involuntary outpatient commitment law. So within a very short time, if the public doesn't realize what it is that's happening to them, they will need to somehow figure out a way to, you know, it's going to be too late when people actually wind up figuring out what's gone on. Because then you're going to be subject to it. People who think that they're not subject to it become subject to it. What happened with Justina Pelletier, for example, and, you know, it's my understanding that she's been transferred to a different place where she's been allowed out with her family and they're working things through. I don't think it's resolved. But, you know, that there are people who are taking their children for medical treatments, being told that the medical diagnosis is fraudulent, having their child taken away from them by Child Protective Services to be mandated into a psychiatric institution at 15 years old, and the parents being threatened with medical neglect if they do not comply with psychiatry that cannot offer one shred of physical evidence for biological causes of anything that is called psychiatric. And so if you'd like to call in and talk to me, my area code is 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. So more to the Office of Mental Health plans here for how it is that people are going to be treated under this involuntary outpatient commitment. There's a section here called Failure to Comply with AOT Order. So OMH writes, if in the clinical judgment of a physician, the assisted outpatient has failed or refused to comply with the treatment ordered by the court and may be in need of involuntary admission to a hospital, the physician may request the Director of Community Services, his or her designee, or other physician designated under Section 9.37 of the Mental Hygiene Law to arrange for the transport of the person to a hospital. If requested, peace officers or police officers must take the individual into custody and transport him or her to the hospital. Ambulance services and OMH-approved mobile crisis outreach teams are authorized but cannot be directed to provide such transport. The individual may be held at the hospital for up to 72 hours for care, observation, and treatment, and to permit a physician to determine whether involuntary admission under the standards set forth in Article 9 of the Mental Hygiene Law is warranted. At any point during the 72 hours, should a determination be made that the individual does not meet involuntary admission criteria, that individual must be released. And so, I mean, people need to understand that you don't need to be in a psychiatric treatment center in order, you know, you don't need to be involuntarily outpatient committed for that to happen to you. Caller 865, 1 second, caller 914, and caller 352, how are you all doing? Caller 865, are you there? Hello? Let's see, technical issue. Caller 914, are you there? Caller 865, hello? Hello? Okay, well, I'm not sure. There are three people on the line right now, and I can't seem to get to them, so maybe we will be able to figure this out. But I'd sure like to know what you have to say.
352 is here, if you could hear me.
352, hi, how are you? Who's calling?
I'm good. This is Frank.
Hi, Frank, how are you?
I'm great.
Yes, you're great. I'm glad you called in. What would you like to talk about?
Well, you know, I couldn't get your show on Blog Talk Radio, so I called so I could hear it. You know, it said press 1 to talk. I didn't press 1, but I guess you know who's on the line anyway.
Oh, it comes up, but it doesn't suggest that they want to. I'm sorry, I'm new at this. It didn't say if they didn't want to, so I don't want to interrupt you if you were just listening, but if you have something to say, feel free to use the time.
Well, I mean, I feel strongly about outpatient commitment too, you know, and that it should not be involuntary, as well as that these drugs are harmful and that this stuff should not be happening right now.
Yeah, it's trying to figure out how to educate people about the mass fraud that is occurring is very difficult. People are, you know, holding on to them as we're losing all of our other constitutional, civil, and human rights, and trying to expose people to the truth about what these drugs are doing is very important. And I think that if we could, I hope anyway, that if we can get to people and have them understand that there is no science behind, there's plenty of evidence of the damage it does, and you know, occasional, you know, evidence of somebody finding benefit. But overwhelmingly, you know, negative experiences, and then maybe that these laws won't continue to get pushed forward the way they will.
Well, I think there's a lot of education needed too, because here in Florida, I don't think, you know, you've got a lot of people that are taking these drugs and they don't understand what they're doing to them. They don't understand how bad the drugs are. So, you know, I mean, the potential harm that is there. So the problem is, how do you educate these people who are listening to the doctor and, you know, think that his word is believe that it's doing them some good or something, because they just feel that they have to take neuroleptic drugs, or I don't know, or they'll lose it.
Yeah, and very often, I mean, I was reading this, I hate to even promote it on any level whatsoever, but I was reading this material today that is just such misinformation, and with a slicing of, like, any ability for future for a future life for somebody who has been assigned one of these labels, particularly schizophrenia, which there is no evidence for. And that all kinds of experiences that people have, whether they be voices or visions or extreme states or spiritual experiences or differing political views, any of this that gets targeted and labeled as schizophrenia, that they're just like out and out saying with no evidence that people will not be able to get jobs, so there's no point in educating them. And this is, it's just such a slice against humanity, and I really hope that we find ways to educate the broader public about a non-funded message, that the pharmaceutical and psychiatric industries aren't pushing them themselves.
Well, I think there's a real big need to educate people here, even before you can have, say a support group of people wishing to taper off because it's that bad. I know some of the people in the peer movement, the one that doesn't take drugs, and most of the others are, they're all on a neuroleptic drug or a mood stabilizer or something.
I really appreciate the struggle that people with informed consent are making that kind of decision. I feel like, in some of the research that I've done, people have told me that part of what they were experiencing was that they felt like they were, like, literally, because they were on the drugs, that they were being controlled. And I feel like it's a whole other element that, obviously the physical control that the drug has over your body and how it stunts us and, makes us incapacitated to physically move or to, have a thought or, and all the other side effects.
Yeah.
But also that it's literally like the means in order to create social control, in order to do the brainwashing, in order to get people to become compliant, that, they need to be on the drugs.
Basically why they put people on these drugs, because they, so that they won't bother someone else. So it's another person is a reason why they put people on drugs. So therefore, you're right, it's about social control.
And that kind of language really upsets some people, and it makes people who feel like if you could get them otherwise without talking about the real issues, that they might come on. But if you start using this kind of language about social control or torture or oppression or anything, that, you're going to lose somebody who might listen otherwise, because people don't want to deal with this reality. They'd like to think that everything is good and that the messages of benevolence that they're getting is, true. But, Frank, in 2014, the APA, Occupy APA slogans of, it was the psychiatrist fooled or complicit. In 2014, how can people still claim that they're fooled?
That they're what?
That they're fooled with all the technology and information and access to, access to information. How could a psychiatrist claim that they're, or a mental health worker, for that matter, claim that they're fooled and that they don't know what psychiatry is really about instead of complicit?
I've always wondered about that. I don't see how psychiatry does it, really. There was a time when I was going to go into human services in Virginia, because this is the way that that several people made it in the peer network there, the system there. But I couldn't do it because this would have, the highest level, the place where I would have been there would have been on a assertive treatment team, an ACT team.
Like an assertive community or assertive community treatment team, an ACT team?
Yes, exactly, an assertive community treatment team. That's where they figured. I mean, they guaranteed you a job with this. But what I would have been doing would probably be bringing the drugs to the patient, and I couldn't say anything because of the doctors.
Right. So just cooperating with the oppression.
Yeah. So I had an issue with the person who was in charge of human services training. She was telling me that maybe I had better not take this, and I said, okay, well, I'm going to adjust my attitude, okay? But then I dropped out because there was no way, you know, that I could do that. And this is the same way some people rose within the peer community in Virginia.
I think it's a really big problem, and now with it all becoming Medicaid billable, of where like people are just going to be mandated onto these teams of force and torture and that they're, you know, and then the other thing is if you step out of line, you're in prime position to be picked up again. So if they don't like what you're saying, then all of a sudden, you know, you must be, you know, in need of a higher level of treatment or, you know, being mandated to comply mm-hmm. with psychiatric drugs in order to keep your job or, you know, things like mm-hmm. that.
Well, in Virginia, the situation is getting worse all the time, especially after this Cray Deeds thing, you know. I mean, it's really scary. But
can you talk about that a little?
Well, his son attacked him with a knife and then committed suicide. But this is following the Virginia Tech stuff that happened a few years ago. And before that, and even before Virginia Tech, there was a Senate commission formed Virginia Supreme Court commission formed to reform the mental health system. So that when the shootings happened at Virginia Tech, it worked right into their hands, you know.
Right. Same as Kendra's Law, right. They were just waiting for the right situation to push it through.
Yeah, yeah, and now the laws have gotten even tougher after the Cray Deeds thing. So he had there happens to be a senator who had a son who attacked him and committed suicide. Who knows the complete circumstances, but because of this case, then they're going to reform the laws in Virginia even further, and they've been reforming these laws. I mean, it just keeps getting worse over there with one incident after another. There was also the incident of that soldier in Northern Virginia. Part of the problem, I guess, is the proximity to D.C. So it all gets thrown into the mix in Richmond, and I'm glad to have gotten out of that state because I figure it's pretty bad up there now.
Huh. I mean it's really frightening when you think about the reach of what these laws are doing and how few of the people who actually like spurred the laws would qualify. Like the person who killed Kendra Webdale wouldn't actually qualify under Kendra's Law. Because mm-hmm. he was seeking out treatment, but kept on being rejected by mental health professionals, and so it wouldn't have solved anything. And people think that this is going to solve something if we put in another law like this, and you know, and it we need other kinds of solutions.
Well, part of the thing about in Virginia is it means more beds, because what they're doing are creating evaluation centers. So. It might not be as bad as like the state hospital. Some of the people are filtered through there to the state hospital. It means that there are going to be, it means more beds, so it's sort of like reinstitutionalization.
And I've actually seen it called reinstitutionalization on the Treatment Advocacy Center's website. In their claims that deinstitutionalization failed, and perhaps what we need now is reinstitutionalization, and it's horrifying. And then on a national level, are you in on any of these Murphy bill conversations, or have you been involved with that at all?
I'm aware of it. I have commented a little bit about that. The idea that he would get rid of the PAMI councils is really disturbing to me, because there's very little oversight and very little rights protection in the mental health system at all. So, I mean,
right.
You get rid of that, and what law exists?
Right.
I mean,
especially
what kind of oversight is there? What kind of grievance system is there?
Right. Do you have any idea in, like, Virginia or where you are now, whether it's what the numbers are looking like as far as how people are being treated, or how many people we're talking about in different involuntary situations?
I'm in Florida. You know, I was talking about Virginia because I'm very familiar with it. I came from that state before I moved down here. As far as Florida goes, I know about the hospital up near Jacksonville in McLennan, which is Northeastern State Hospital, and there are about 600 people there. When I was in Virginia, I was at their Western State Hospital in the 90s, and there were 250 people there.
Okay,
now,
so
this
like
is a
almost
that was a place that it had like 2,000 or so of some people in the 70s.
Okay.
But that didn't mean it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of people, and trying to get people to understand how many people we're talking about here is always consistently going to be key. I have a caller from area code 111. Hello, are you waiting to talk? No. Okay. It may be just somebody else listening. If any of you would like to jump in, feel free to do so. So I think that when you look at the numbers, almost 6,000 people in New York State who are involuntary outpatient commitment, but then, in New York State, it's about 170,000 people a week that are being served in some form or fashion, and people don't realize that, you know, these are huge amounts of people that are being subject to this, and if you're in some kind of psychiatric service, voluntarily, very often, especially in the state services, when you no longer want to be voluntary, they make you involuntary. So
you're saying it's 6,000, and this is outpatient.
In the involuntary outpatient commitment, I'm just trying to look at. I think over time, it's been in the thousands. So, yeah, okay, it's gone up since the last time I looked at it. So statewide, there have been 18,389 investigations into people in the last, I guess, it looks like it's since the beginning of the program in 1999. Kind of hard to see how they're working this out, but by statewide there were 12,044 petitions granted, and 12,044 petitions granted, and 11,681. No, I just did the same thing. Anyway, 97% of the petitions granted, filed were granted. So 97%. Seems to be an outrageously huge number.
Well, what was that figure you came up with before? Was that inpatient commitment?
The involuntary outpatient commitment under people under Kendra's law, under court order. And so since November 1999, there have been 11,673 people under it, and during
what?
The last 12 months, there have been 3,147 people.
Oh, I'm not on the phone. I'm listening to the blog radio about
involuntary. Oh, you are on the phone. got it. And with 97% of the petitions filed, granted, you know, only 3% of the people who were investigated didn't meet the criteria. Either the criteria is you know, it's just inappropriate.
So that's
and then
like
if you,
they, like that means that they commit people 98% of the time.
97% of the time. If you're petitioned to be on the Kendra's Law, on the involuntary outpatient commitment, 97% of the time the petition is granted. And so, and then non-orders. If there was a non-order that was created, the reasons. The rate of renewal and the rate of people that are being affected, and then if you start to look at, like, you know, economically, they're not putting out involuntary outpatient commitment laws on people who have money, right? So it's the first discrimination across the board is money. And then there's over-representation of people of color who are being targeted by this, mostly because of institutional and structural racism, because of money, and because of the prejudice that people, you know, in larger societal structure. And so it's getting carried out, you know, in the report about it. They said whether you see this as something that is helpful or something that is a... infringement on people's civil rights is whether or not you see psychiatry as helpful. And it goes back to, Frank, what you were saying earlier, that, you know, that this whole idea that they have no evidence. They just have no evidence. And so why they get to keep on creating laws based on this field and fueling this multi-trillion-dollar field industry, I just don't understand.
And I suppose that the 3% that are not committed, this is, you know, I mean, there's no real justice system there or anything, or determination. It's simply because it goes through a judge or something, isn't it?
Right, and so a judge who has no medical training ultimately is making decisions about what individuals have to comply with medically. It's just ridiculous. I want to give out the number again if you're listening and want to call in to talk. It's area code 267-521-0167. If you have something to say about your own experiences or things that you've witnessed or things that you're working on, please give a call. Area code 267-521-0167. And so, you know, back to the assisted involuntary outpatient commitment programmings, this idea that, you know, what they think is acceptable to do to people and the drugging of them is outrageous. There's a couple of events that are coming up in the next short period of time. On June 19th, it will be the 6th annual vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green, who was murdered by neglect at Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room, June 19th, 2008. That will be on June 19th in front of Kings County Hospital Center on Clarkson Street in Brooklyn, and I will be getting more information about that soon. And then... there's going to be the Mind Freedom Conference in Connecticut. Frank, have you been involved with this?
Well, I've paid the registration. I'm trying to get it straightened out. I'm figuring out how to get from perhaps the airport in Hartfield to Litchfield is yet a problem, but hopefully I'll get there. Yeah, so I'm intending to go.
Awesome. I'm hoping to be there for some of the time. I'm trying to get to the web page to just give an update about it. Why are you going? What's your motivating
factor
for going?
I was at the last conference in 07, and I offered to give a presentation on creating landing zones to help people
Great.
Escape from or to find a way out of involuntary outpatient commitment.
Fabulous. The conference is called the 2014 Creative Revolution Conference, Developing and Expanding Alternatives, and it's July 24th to July 27th, 2014. The conference is still open for registration, and the Choices in Mental Health Committee of Mind Freedom International is offering a $10 discount until May 1st, and we may be past May 1st by now. But it looks really interesting, and it says people who are interested in learning about or discussing how to develop new alternatives are encouraged to register. Also, we want to invite those who have developed or expanded alternatives to the mental health system in the USA and in other countries. If you're just interested in hearing about alternatives, you're also welcome. And so it looks like it's going to be a really interesting time and a great time for bonding and being with like-minded people. And you can find out more information about that at mindfreedom.org. And then in July is going to be the 34th annual Bastille Days demonstration and celebration and vigil, which will be held on the street in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health in Albany, New York. And that will be for 72 hours because they can keep us for 72 hours and assess us and treat us. And then determine whether or not they want to keep us longer and that everyone is at risk. And that's going to be on from July 13th at 6 p.m. until July 16th at 6 p.m. If there are other people who would like to come in and talk about this, I've got another caller on the line. It looks like it's from area code 406.
Yeah.
Are you there?
Caller
yes. Area. Hi, who's
me?
Calling? Yes.
This is Genevieve. Hello?
I'm sorry. Yes, hi. Who is calling?
My name's Genevieve. I was calling.
Hi, Genevieve. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I kind of want to talk about the involuntary outpatient commitment. When I was calling of I heard you guys talking about how to get off of an involuntary outpatient commitment because I am on an outpatient commitment right now. So
you are on it. What state are you in, if I can ask?
I'm in Montana.
Montana has an involuntary outpatient commitment law. Getting off of them is my understanding is can be difficult.
Yeah.
How long have you been on it?
Oh, over a year, probably almost a year and a half. I originally signed a 3-month commitment. I was told either I sign the commitment or I go to the state hospital for 3 months. So I signed the commitment, and then it's just continuously been renewed. It just got renewed last week.
Yeah, but they have to keep recommitting you, don't they?
What's that?
Do they have to keep recommitting you? You said there were an original 3 month commitment.
Yeah, it was an original 3 months, and then it's been extended 6 months, and then 6 months again, and it was just renewed another 6 months, and they said it could just keep going. When I asked
That's
how long
crazy.
It was going to last. Yeah, they were like, oh, it could be another 6 months, could be a year, could be longer. We don't know how long it's going to last.
Do you know if you could get out of the state of Montana, they can't do anything?
Oh, really? Yeah, I've thought about doing that. It's just my family is here in Montana, where I'm from, so that would be hard.
Yeah, I understand that it could be difficult, but it's like I'm saying, if it's possible to move to relocate from the state, then they don't have any hold over you in another state.
Oh, really?
that's part of what our idea of creating landing zones would be all about. That is creating places where the resources exist and maybe where people could help people settle coming from elsewhere who are subjected to these outpatient commitment laws.
Yeah. They didn't used to have the outpatient thing. It's all new.
So I'm just wondering, when they did the first original one that they said it was going to be for 3 months, what gave them the right to do it then?
Well, I was in the psych ward, and they told me, if you want to get out of here, you have to sign this outpatient commitment. Otherwise, we're going to send you to the state hospital. That's what they told me. And so I was like, well, it's only 3 months, you know, and I don't want to go to the state hospital, and I need to get out of here. So.
And what about your lawyer?
Oh, yeah, they have a lawyer, and I talked to the lawyer, but it's basically like, you know, the judge sides with the psychiatrist no matter what. And when they were renewing, so there's really no point, a waste of time. When they renewed it this last time, they talked about that at the end, that, you know, I have a lawyer and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I don't remember exactly how it all panned out, but he was like, you know, nobody ever wins. And he's like, no, some people have, but they've been on commitment much longer than you have. So it's like, yeah.
And so now you said it's been more than a year this is going on now?
Yeah, it's been over a year, like a year and 3 months, I think. So.
And do you want to be off it?
Yes, very much. They keep pushing. They're really pushing the injectables. They want everybody to be on injectables. And
are they giving you injectables?
Not me, but they have tried it. They've tried several times to get me to go on injectables, and I've refused. And they said this time, well, if I went on the injectables, then I could be done with the med prompts and all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. So, but I fear that someday not wanting to do the injectables is going to be considered refusing medication.
Could you define what the injectables mean for anybody who might not know exactly what you're talking about?
Oh, they have the Invega shot. You get one shot a month, and then you're good for the month. So a lot of people do it because they think it's easier than having to take the meds. You just do a shot instead. And they have other shots, like I think they have a risperidol shot. I refuse to do the shot, but...
So they're like, for anybody who doesn't understand, they're like time-released shots that last for a month,
yeah.
And then you only go once a month, and then you don't have to take the pills every day. But
yeah,
are you mandated on drugs?
Yes, I have to take my meds every night. They come to my door. So
wait, what?
Part of my commitment is that I have to take my meds every night. They have the med prompters come to the door every night and watch me take my meds. So
I'm sorry, what are they called? Med what?
Med prompters.
Prompters?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that hasn't reached New York yet. This is the first I'm hearing about this. Can you tell me what this
heard.
Is?
Med, it's just these young college students that come and they watch you take your meds every night, basically. So,
a young college student comes to your house every night and watches you take
yes.
your meds?
Yes.
This is
yeah.
very 1984 type stuff.
It really is big.
Yeah.
Can I ask how old you are?
Me?
Yeah.
I'm in my 30s.
You're in your 50s.
No, my 30s. 30s.
Oh, your 30s. I was going to say you sound very young. Okay.
You're in your 30s
and you have a college student show up at your house every night. So somebody who isn't licensed or certified or just somebody who is a college student show up at your house to make sure that you take your medication.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do you have to meet them at your house? What if you're out?
Well, they're fairly like if you're like, oh, you know, I'm out of town or whatever, then they're like, okay, don't worry about it. Just take your meds or whatever. But if you're out, then you miss them. And then they're like, oh, you need to, if you miss too many of them, then they start to get on your case about it. So.
And what would happen if you said no?
I haven't tried doing that. It's like I have a young daughter, and I just want to get done with this, and so I can move on with my life and take care of her. You know, I don't want to keep doing this over and over again. And I've been through this so many times. I know what it's like when you refuse medication. So I'm not gonna do that. I don't know what happens if you do. So.
But you're not willing to take the chance, and you want to just legally get yourself off of this so that you don't have to do it anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't want to have to do this anymore. So.
And that's the shame of it. Perhaps have you talked to anybody at the Protection and Advocacy in Montana?
Advocacy. I don't know if there's a protection and advocacy in Montana that I know of. There's a disability right that I talked to, but they weren't very helpful.
Let's see, because every state is supposed to have a protection and advocacy. And that's one of the things that the Murphy Bill is trying to wipe out.
That was a Murphy bill.
Yeah, do you know anything about that?
I've read a little bit, but I can't remember very much right now.
So I'm just looking here because there, and it looks like it is disability rights. That is the protection and advocacy for Montana.
Yeah, I talked to them. But I didn't get anywhere, so I was really frustrated by that.
Perhaps there's a way to do like a Mind Freedom Alert Shield or something. Frank, do you have any ideas here?
That could be done, but you'd have to join Mind Freedom.
Right.
I mean, easiest way would be to. You are a member of Mind Freedom?
Oh, I was. I need to renew. I have.
It would probably be easiest if you were to join again. And then someone could draw up an alert for you.
Okay.
And maybe there's some way to...
That would be good.
Sorry, go ahead, Genevieve.
Oh, I was just going to say that would be good. I've been meaning to call and do that, actually. Because I did that before, but that was a different situation. I don't know if I actually did a shield alert then, though.
Well, maybe there's some way that we can do that, and also to find out about maybe, you know, a couple of phone calls over to different people about your, you know, especially mental hygiene legal services. They're supposed to be representing you. That's why they're our defenders. They are supposed to be making a case for us in order to be able to get out of this. And so it sounds like some of what you experienced is this thing that they're now calling the black robe effect. And we talked about it last night on the show a little bit of the judge's black robe having the effect that people have to do this. And so it sounds like from the very beginning you were coerced into signing this. out of threat of and fear of being institutionalized in a state facility, and that they keep on, you know, mandating you to this, and that you just want, you know, to have your freedom. And so I feel like, you know, your lawyer should be responding to you and should be supporting you. And, you know.
Well, I'm thinking if you have a court-appointed lawyer, a public defender, that can be the problem in some cases, because they feel, because sometimes they feel like, you know, they're obligated to lose the case. They shouldn't. They should defend you. But, you know, that's happened sometimes. But I figured if you could get some kind of decent counsel, you shouldn't be committed indefinitely.
Yeah. Yeah, they made it seem like it just could go on forever, basically, at the last one. I was like, how long is this go on? And he's like, oh, it could be 6 months, it could be a year, it could be longer, we don't know. So.
Well, I think that there's definitely got to be something that can be done in order to have your side of the situation heard and to get you off of this. My email, if you want to email me directly, is laurentenney@aol.com.
Okay.
And my Facebook is /TennyLauren. And so if you want to give me a call after the show or, you know, during the week or whatever, and I'll try to, you know, find somebody who might know a way to point you. At least, you know, from New York. I don't know the first thing about. I'm just stuck on these. What did you call them? Medication prompters.
Sorry.
I'm still a little stuck on the medication prompter thing. It boggles my mind. Beyond the drugs and the, you know, college students showing up at your house to make sure you've taken your drugs, are there other things that the involuntary law there requires? Do you do?
Well, I have to make it to all the meetings with the psychiatrists and the caseworkers and the MHPs and stuff like that. If I miss the meetings or I'm missing all the med prompts, then they could send me to the state hospital. They do have that authority. They can do that. And I actually had a psychiatrist threaten me with that. And that was really scary. So she just said, you know, if you don't take all your med prompts when they're there and if you don't make it to the meeting, I could have you hauled away. This is your child. She threatened me with that. It was horrible.
That must be so frightening. How does that help? You know, on whatever level, how does that create a supportive, helpful environment for anybody? Let alone, it amazes me. How many times a week are you in meetings then with these people?
Oh, I had last week. I had like 3 meetings, but usually it's just like once or twice a month. It's not usually that much, but I changed to the other psychiatrist, but so far it's been a little bit better. But she could still do the same things as the other one threatened to do. So she has that authority. But I appreciate you. I'm really appreciative that you guys are doing this.
Well, I thank you for calling. And if there's anything else you'd like to share or you know, talk about, that would be great, because I think that people need to be educated as to exactly what can happen to anybody and that it's not this, you know, image of who they have in their mind of who this is happening to. I do want to give out the number again in case you're listening. It's area code 267-521-0167. If you want to call in and talk about something, area code 267-521-0167. So, are you still there? Maybe not. Genevieve, were you going to say something? Okay, so this article that got published today, or I'm not sure if it was today, got published at some point. There doesn't seem to be a clear date on it. The 16th, May 16th, on Pete Early's blog was a guest blog written by DJ Jaffe, who put out an article about 8 myths about serious mental illness. And while I hate the language, I'm just reading what he's been saying. And so there's so much misinformation that's being put out to the public about this, and people who are just actively working to destroy us are getting a platform. And so there's this one statement that he makes that says 90% of the most seriously ill will not recover enough to become competitively employed, so job training and back-to-school programs are of little utility. And I just have to say I've never heard more dehumanizing kind of attitude toward people and a limiting of any potential human growth and development than that. The idea that people shouldn't be given opportunities to better themselves and be encouraged to go on to get education or training of what they may desire is just horrifying. The idea that we would be telling the general public that somebody who has a psychiatric history doesn't have any chance at being able to work is the most discriminatory kind of thing that you can do. You know, if one of the main problems that people are facing in this country is homelessness, one of a surefire way to fix that is by creating opportunities for people to better their economic standing. And so creating training programs and education programs of people's choice, I think, is incredibly important. Is there somebody on the line? Okay, maybe. If you're there, jump in. So I feel like we really need to be educating people about what the reality is versus how it is that information is getting spread. The idea that involuntary outpatient commitment programs, programming, I should say, it has any kind of positive effect is just not true. They have not been proven. They are still controversial. And, you know, when you have people who otherwise would be contributing and, participating in our society, we have them excluded and unable to be part of that participation. And I think that these are major issues that we need to address. If you'd like to call in, the number is 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. So people have been posting some things up on my Facebook page, and one of them is this article on the lunaticfringe.wordpress.com called Education and Alternatives to Psychiatric Drug Abuse. And so this person is writing...
That person is me.
You're still here. And
yeah,
that is you. So would you care to talk a little bit about what you're writing about?
Well, basically what I was talking about before, I mean, I feel that the education is lacking where I'm at because there are so many people that are taking these, that are on neuroleptic drugs and mood stabilizers. They don't really realize, you know, that they could be doing themselves harm. And I think that's a matter of education. I always think these drugs are pretty bad for people.
I agree. The sentence that you read, sorry, go ahead.
And I think we have a problem because I'm in the South, and I've been in the South all my life, and most of the places around here are very much behind other places. So where I'm living now in Gainesville, according to a Yale study, is the place where neuroleptics, where they're dishing out neuroleptics at a higher level than anywhere else in the country. They did this survey, and Gainesville, Florida came up on top. You know, NAMI is very big in this state. So the problem I see is how do you deal with people I think we really need support groups to help people come off these drugs, but before we can do that, people have to figure out that really, taking the drug is not the greatest thing to do.
Yeah, I think it's a message that we need to get. I'm curious if you would talk a little bit, for anybody who might not know about what NAMI is, would you give an overview and maybe some of your perspective about it?
The National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. It's an organization that was founded by relatives of people thought to be disturbed, the same relatives that sometimes put them in the hospital to have them committed, you know, are dealing with relatives that perhaps they subconsciously hate or something, therefore they're going to subject them to this stuff. But it's also heavily funded by the drug companies. If you go to their Florida website, it says how they list two drug companies, in fact, as sponsors of NAMI.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of
Didn't something come out in the papers about them actually receiving too much money from pharmaceutical industry?
Well, they were a subject of the Charles Grassley investigation. And at some point they admitted that they were receiving all this money from the drug companies, which accounted for more than 50% of the funds of the money they were taking in. So so much of the money behind NAMI was coming from the drug companies.
Right.
And this was a while back, at least in Florida, it still seems to be the case.
And I think that there's a very well organized, well funded machine that is driving these points home. I think in some ways we're being, as a movement, we're starting to become somewhat successful again, in that they're calling what we're saying myths and trying to refute what it is that we're saying. And at the same time, I'm horrified by it. So the eighth myth, for example, that DJ Jaffe puts out in this guest blog on the PeteEarley.com is that everyone recovers. And underlined, it says some people do not, period. And so they're working very hard, and in that blurb is the plug for the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, H.R. 3717. As the solution to it. But this idea that A, this thing exists, and B, is something that people couldn't recover from are both fraudulent. Somebody should be holding these people responsible for the material they're putting out.
Are you talking about NAMI?
Well, NAMI, mentalillnesspolicy.org, anybody who gives these PTORI, anybody who's giving these people a platform, the Treatment Advocacy Center,
we just had a problem here. You know, this is after they had Fred Freeze, who's on the board of directors of the Treatment Advocacy Center, come down here to give a talk. Recently, this is what NAMI did a couple of years ago. This year, they had Pete Early come down, the person who you were talking about, BJ Jaffe, being on his blog. You know, and that was crazy as far as I'm concerned. They bought 300 copies of Pete Early's books. Crazy. And they had community discussions about it all over Gainesville.
Really?
If you could, really. You know, and it
could
was
you?
It was a scare. I was a part of one of these discussions. I went to the discussion at the Civic Media Center, which is our independent radical library locally. And it was scary because there was really no understanding, you know, of our issues there, I didn't think. And there was not a real, you know, I don't know where NAMI's going with this. I just get the idea that, you know, I'm hoping they invite Ethel or Tori down here or DJ Jaffe, because I see it coming. You know, Pete Early. It's really sad. It's really sad. You know, how do you fight this?
What's that message about?
Peter Lee's son, Mike, he was put into the mental health. Well, actually, his parents were trying to get him into treatment. His father was spiking his, Pete Early was spiking his son with his son's food with some neuroleptic drug at some point anyway, too, but he was trying to get him into treatment. And ultimately the guy broke into a house and he got arrested, so he was facing a trial and he had to go through that. So Pete Early goes down to Dade County to investigate the situation of the people in the criminal justice system in jail in Dade County who are said to have mental illness. He got his son off. It was pretty tight, you know. I mean, there was I thought it was going to be pretty easy there, but he got him off because one of the people whose house he broke into, there was a day when they could show up to show up to court when an appearance was scheduled, and so they just dismissed it. But the book itself is, you know, I mean, bottom line, people go into the criminal justice system because they break the law.
Right.
I'm sure that there are a lot of people with problems in the criminal justice system. That's just to be expected in prison. And there are too many people in prison. But
they're mushing the issues together instead of keeping them separate.
That's right. I mean, you don't have a clear line between mental health and criminal justice.
And then the addition of the issues of solitary confinement and the drugging in prisons, the prison industrial complex. An entire new situation has to be created. Area 661, are you there? Okay, maybe just listening. If you want to jump in, area code 661, please do. So I think so.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. What do you want to talk about? Who is this?
This is Philip Mark Fabre. Actually, the area code is 503, but I guess that's the Skype area code I'm calling from.
Perhaps. Philip, how are you tonight?
I'm a little disconcerted. I have sort of the preliminary fix, the cure to all this, involuntary commitment and whatnot, just the memory engrams of a better system. But I want to know, like, what do I get for sharing my troubles? I mean, there's nothing that will set it right for me. I was actually incarcerated twice in the state of Oregon, civilly committed, falsely. At least one time it was overturned. But what do I get for sharing all of that? I mean, and if I have cured myself as well as possible, I mean, there's no fix for it. I mean, you're once a mental patient, always a mental patient. My one question I wanted to call in and ask is, what do I get if I fix it? Just the self-respect that I fixed it? I mean, should I help these doctors sort out their business?
Well, I agree with you there. I don't quite see it that way. I do see it, though, as trying to get information to other people who might be subject to this that they can get out to and that they don't have to buy it. And from that, from the connections that I've been able to make with other people who have psychiatric histories, who are psychiatric survivors, that to me is what I get from it, of being able to have that connection and hopefully reach somebody who, you know, may need another message. But what do you get from it? A lot of headaches, a lot of pain, a lot of aggravation, a lot of people saying that you don't know what you're talking about.
I get that. I feel your pain on that. I think that's really what I was calling about.
You know, so every time I can get to one more person and maybe, you know, give them faith to speak up for themselves and that there are other ways and that you can get out, it makes all the other stuff worth it. But in between those things, it's hard and painful trying to fight this machine.
I think I'll just share some rudimentary components to what I've figured out. Because I do feel like you're here and you're a friend to the cause. And that's what I need more than anything, is just friends. You know, maybe it takes getting status to make the right friends, but, you know, just being respected is important. So I'll try and make this concise and accurate, but I'm not all put together. So basically what I've figured out is that they're all lacking a legal education. These psychiatrists, these orderlies, they don't have what is essentially a psychiatric implement, the law. They're not versed in it. They have the power from the law to do these things to people, but yet there's no two-way street with the law. So it's not only that the psychiatrists don't know how to handle these situations legally, but the law itself is flawed. So it's really a double whammy for any person coming under the purview of the system. You know, and the only way out is to be competent in the law, more competent than they are, to trust it more than they do. That's the only thing I can say.
Well, I think through the law we have a possibility to change things, but I like that point that you made about the law being flawed. The law allows these things to happen to us. The law is a violation of our constitutional rights. And then everybody hides
behind
simple. The law.
I'm sorry, I don't mean... Yeah, they hide behind it. They use it, but they don't know about it. Isn't that a Hippocratic sort of thing? Isn't that hypocritical? I mean, if they use the law but they're not competent in it, they're not treating the whole patient. The patient is part and parcel with the law, you know, because it's a psychiatric implement that society uses to make people sane. And I'm just saying, like, they got to get competent. I mean, the power dynamics are obviously flawed in the observed environment, the hospitals, but the particulars of that is that they don't know the law, and they don't expect you to know the law. And that's what it is that, you know, in Oregon, there's a law, it's Oregon Revised Statute 426.295, which states that no person by virtue of incarceration shall be considered mentally incompetent. And I guess this mental incompetence label is for getting out of paying bills and for people who are really bad off and need guidance. What are those? Guardians.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other issue, right? Okay.
Yeah. So it's the whole thing is this whole thing boils down to they need to prove that they're not treating people as mental incompetents. That is the focus that this movement should be on, pushing forward with, you can't prove you're not treating them as mental incompetents. You can't prove it. And the only way you're going to prove it is if you get competent in the law and not just medicine.
And then have to be held to some kind of ethical standard about competence in medicine, right? as if psychiatry is a, you know, a vetted actual scientific enterprise instead of just a business on its own. I think that these are really important points, and you know, you whatever section of the mental hygiene law that you just rattled off, can I ask you, have you ever been intimidated by, like, you know, the numbers and having to remember all these different details and trying to figure out how do I get this into my, you know, new understanding and knowledge?
Absolutely. I've been so disorganized, and I still am really disorganized. But I believe in virtue, and I think it's all that held me together in those situations, those moments of crucifixion by society, so to speak, where you would be dead. Society made that turn on you in olden days. You know, and we've gotten
right.
A lot better, and there's a lot of forgiveness in it. There's a lot of forgiveness of these people. Just realizing that not anybody's perfect. I'm not coming across clear at all times, but the words are my heart.
Well, you sound pretty clear to me. And I get it. And, you know, there are individuals who are caught up in this thing, and then there's the system. And it's the system that's the problem, right? There are a lot of, you know, and to be able to forgive, I mean, that was Gandhi had the, you know, the gift for that, and others. I'm not as forgiving, and I think that that's a great virtue. I think that it's something I actually aim toward, but I also think that this the intimidation of trying to figure out your way through and to have the support to learn even what the laws are that you're being subjected to. So many people aren't even told that. And they're just
They'll throw a
totally
whole booklet in front of you and say, figure it out, you know?
Right, without any real guidance. I want to bring in another caller here. Area code 845. Please stay on the line, Phil. And Frank. Area code 845.
Hi, Lauren. This is Anthony from Rockland, New York.
Hey, Anthony. How you doing? You had given us a good. I've also got Phil and Frank on the line. And we were just talking about laws and being able to know what the laws you're subject to are. And you were planned on coming in tonight, so thanks for calling. Would you like to update everybody as to what you want to talk about?
Yeah, I actually would. I'd like to comment on the AOT policy in New York State.
Okay.
I've been on AOT for 2.5 years now, and I have private health insurance through my employer. So they said that I have 1 month left, but then they told me that the county wanted to renew it. I think this is financially motivated. I think it's a money racket, to be honest with you. And I think it's actually been proven that they've been making billions of dollars off of health insurance companies. What do you think? What is your comment on that?
Oh, my comment is I think that you're absolutely on the money, and that this is a trillion-dollar industry that is full of greed at the cost of human rights and civil rights and constitutional rights and taking our person. And what you said before, once a mental patient, always a mental patient. Like when you said that, I know exactly what you mean. And they have made a population of people that they are just getting rich off of. And then there's a whole other populations of people who are carrying it out, who aren't necessarily getting rich, but are getting their bills paid. And I think it's a big problem in exposing these financial incentives from the drug companies, from the courts, from the psychiatric industry itself, the programs that carry this out. This is big money and big taxpayer money also. But Anthony, you said you're on. Sorry, go ahead.
Can I catch the rest of the show on Blog Talk Radio on Just Hang Up Now?
I believe so. Yep, I believe
okay.
so.
Okay, thanks for your time. I'm a friend
okay,
on Facebook
you.
With you, so I really appreciate your time. Thank
Great.
You.
Great. And give me a shout out so that I know exactly who you are, okay? Thanks.
Philip Mark Fabry.
Okay. Thanks, Philip.
Goodbye.
Bye. So, Anthony, you said something about being private insurance?
Yeah, I have private insurance coverage through my employer. And my theory is that they want to keep me on AOT because I think they're getting a lot of money from my insurance company. And if for me to go off AOT and get like a private, go private, they would lose all that money, the county.
Wow, I wonder what private insurance companies feel about this as part of their being mandated into it also. I also have another caller at area code 304. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, who's this?
This is Les Levinson.
Hi, Les.
Hey.
Great. Hi. So we've got Anthony and Frank and Les on the phone now. And so, Anthony, I was just a little surprised that private insurance companies were paying. I don't know why I'm surprised. I guess I knew this, that private insurance companies are paying for involuntary outpatient commitment programming. And so they're being mandated by the state also in some kind of way. Les, do you have a comment or question for anybody?
No, I've just been living with issues, mental health issues with myself, my family. I know I've been dealing with it for years like many people, and I think that people kind of lose sight of the big picture is trying to find blame and trying to find reasons, to you know, to well because of the way they feel or they don't understand how they feel, whatever. But I think you have to look at, you know, understanding oneself, you know, as far as how you are, how you feel, as you know, at that particular time, and then if other people can understand you. To me, I think we just got a big problem in communication, generally speaking. If you look around, I mean, the way we communicate today is a lot different than 20 years ago. You can go on online media, go on these chat rooms, people talk, but you don't really, sometimes you can be beneficial and learn a lot of things if you're in the right groups or in the right places. But just in general conversation, I think we're missing the boat. Communication, it'll go so far and dies. Am I right or am I wrong?
Well, I think that we do need to be able to talk and that there are a lot of people who, for many different reasons, are angry, and so that always creates a block in the communication. But I think that, you raise some important issues, and people need to understand.
I mean, people that have mental health issues that have, depending on the level of seriousness, a lot of times people cannot understand himself, cannot even talk to explain what's going on to a doctor or what. And we're living in still trying to figure out in health problems and health treatments what's best, and we've been dependent on a dinosaur way of treatment, because if you depend highly on medication, then that's what you're going to be living on is medication. And if for every time we go to a doctor, if our head hurts and get a pill, that's not the answer. I think we should be in maybe more of a preventive mood for mental and physical well-being, and where we work on that, and trying to get out communication where we can really understand people and have more dialogues like you're doing and have more open talks to get a feel of what people go through. I mean, my God, I mean, I guess I stay busy all the time. People don't know what people go through. They just don't. And they just so fixed on their own selves, it's pathetic. And I just thought that as a decent human being, it's part of responsibility. It's not just trying to make hay for yourself and your family. It's thinking about others, maybe somebody misfortunate. I mean, I just don't get it. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think people are really easy caught up in their own lives, and then also really easy to believe the myths about, you know, who we are and what people who
That's it. I mean, you know, you can talk about the drug thing until the cows come home. You can tell how wrong it is, but it's not going to change one thing. With billions and billions of dollars being spent every day on medications, on whatnot, on whatever ailment, you think the doctors and the lawyers and the pharmaceutical company are going to go out of business because there's so many people against it? I doubt it. I just think there's just not enough people, you know, that's on the right bandwagon to fight for a just cause, whatever it is, and to make it right. I mean, that's just my feeling. I go on to a lot of groups. I see whether it be for drugs, wrong, this is wrong. People aren't treated right in communities. They don't have their medical, they don't have the right treatment. And mostly in small communities is the worst because they have less resources. So I'm just telling you, I struggle every day to make it. But, you know, I find things to be happy about. I don't know. Maybe I'm weird or something, but I try to find happiness whatever I do, and I still fight for causes. You know what I mean? But I can get on the... Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. You got just got
no,
me
no,
started.
No. Les, I think you're making really good points, and I think that, you know, we do need to find happiness inside of it all. I think that one of the reasons why I'm trying to create a kind of public conversation about the drugs, as other people are, is because there are people who, Anthony, what, 2.5 years now?
2.5 years, yep.
Yeah, 2.5 years being court-ordered into it, you know, over one's own objections. And if we can start to put, you know, the truth out about what is happening to people, that maybe those conversations can come. But it's all about relationships, and I think that, you know, people need to, you know, or would benefit anyway from, you know, being more open to people and having, you know, and finding happiness. But, you know, when you're, you know, in what does Eric Faber call it, a chemical incarceration, you know, when you're being forcibly drugged, it's really hard to find that. And then people become intimidated trying to fight back. I want to cut in for one second because we have a caller from 718 on the line.
Well, okay, that's fine. I just thought I'd say hello and voice my opinion, whatever it's worth. And I just wanted to tell everybody out there that I support everybody, you know, with the, no matter what situation has to deal with anything, with mental health issues, drugs or whatever. There's so many unfair things going on that we all have to deal with in all communities. It's not just one thing. There's a multitude of problems. And it's just the surface, I think. We're just touching the surface. And I just think that there's got to be more educational awareness going over all the time where people can know what's going on with people. And they can know that as well as they know everything else on that's advertised on TV. And they should be able to read more articles and stuff like that to become aware that, you know, the problems that people are having today, that problem can be happening to you tomorrow. I mean, I'm just...
That's right.
I mean, you know, and nobody's immune. Nobody's immune. So that's the sad part, that if people don't realize, you know, that they might think this, you know, it's not an important problem. Why should people even think about spending time trying to figure out solutions for the drugs? Well, you know why? Because it's not involved them. Go ahead and take care of the next caller. I just wanted to say a few words
Absolutely. And if you want to hang on the line, hang on, because we still have room. I have a caller from 303 area code.
I'll hang on a few minutes. Go ahead. Go get him.
Eric,
oh, that's me.
Hi. That's who I'm sorry.
Aubrey Shomo from Colorado.
Oh, hey, Aubrey. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. So, Anthony, I just want to give you a little bit of time. Would you mind talking about what you'd like to see happen or what that is? And then I want to get to an update about what's going on in Colorado.
Okay, do you want like a general like a synopsis or like my own situation, like an account of my own situation?
Whatever you feel comfortable. Well, how do you think maybe airing some of this stuff might you know, assist you and other people who might be in the same boat? What you know, or who may never have heard of this, and you know, what's important for somebody to know about this, because you have firsthand experience of it. So
yeah, I personally think that if somebody should have the option open for treatment, if medication is for you and it's going to help you cope with whatever you're going through, then I think that should be your choice. But I don't think it should be forced on somebody. I don't think medication should be forced on anybody if they don't want it. I personally don't agree with being medicated, and with me, the medications really mess with my emotional functioning and my sexual drive and my social interactions. It really kind of messes with me, and I really don't like it. And it also affects me physically, because I'm also an endurance athlete, and I run marathons, and I can't run up to my potential because the medications take away from my physical explosiveness. There's a lot of different interactions that these medications have with the human body. And for me, I don't think that I don't think it should be forced on anybody, but if it helps people, they should have the choice. The choice should always be open. I think you should be given
a choice. With informed consent, people should be able to do whatever drug they want to do. But you're saying that, are you being forced to take drugs?
Yeah, I'm on AOT. It's court ordered.
Okay.
If I don't show up for my monthly injection, they send Rockland County Sheriffs to my house to arrest me. That's
to
what
arrest
happened.
You.
No,
so
they don't arrest you. They take you in a squad car to get hospitalized.
Oh,
that's what
God.
Happens. So if you don't show up for your injection, they give you a call, and if you don't respond to the phone call, then they send sheriff's deputies to your house, and then they'll try to negotiate with you to get out. If you refuse, then they take you by force to get hospitalized and inpatient. That's what they do. It's never happened to me, but I've been compliant the whole time. That's why they said I only have a month left, and I'm afraid that.
Congratulations.
I'm afraid that they're going to try to renew it because my like I said before, my insurance has pretty good coverage.
And so, as long as the insurance is willing to continue to pay for it, they'll continue to renew it.
They may want to continue to renew it for financial means. Yep, that's right.
What a scam! The things that you described of the way that the drugs are limiting your experience of day-to-day life, that just has to add to extra burden on it and, make it more, dehumanizing. But then to not even have done anything criminal, but to having to have interaction with the police over that if you were not to comply, that the crime is not taking a drug. The Partnership for Drug Free America should know about this. Oh wait, they fund it. So how do you bring it all together?
Well, I'm really hoping because I have documentation that when they renewed it for six month increments from March of 2012 till now. The last one's been 3. In March, they said that if my progress remained the same, they wouldn't renew it. So since I have that piece of paper, I asked my psychiatrist that my court order psychiatrist, and he said that since I have that, it shouldn't be a problem. So it shouldn't be a problem, but if there is an issue, I'm going to fight in a court with the attorney.
That's important. That's important to do to fight. And so have your experiences, could you, I don't think people can really get their heads around the idea that like you have to go to court, about not complying with medical treatment for a diagnosis that can't be proven to exist. Would you be willing to share what some of those experiences are like?
Yeah, what it is is you're given two options. When you're on AOT in New York State, you're given two options. Your first option is you could either waive your right to a court hearing so you don't have to go and they just automatically renew it. The second option is you go to a court hearing and you go in front of a judge and you have a mental health legal hygiene service attorney appointed to you by the county in New York, and they have the psychiatrist go on the stand and he testifies and he says, this is the person's psychiatric history. This is what they've done. This is why they should be on AOT. This is what would happen if they weren't medicated. And basically, the judge, no matter what you say, the judge is always going to side with the psychiatrist because the second to last time that I had an AOT hearing, I actually spoke because they give you an opportunity to speak, and I spoke and I said that I've been compliant with my medication and I haven't had any problems, no hospitalizations, et cetera, and they always side with the psychiatrist. It's just set up. It's a whole thing staged. It's just to get you back on AOT.
It sounds like just really coordinated. I'm just wondering, the first time you found out that you had to go to court about this, do you remember like what that moment was like to find out that there even was a court?
I didn't even know like this stuff exists. Like you had to go to court to be medicated, and the first time that I was just taken back. I was amazed because my whole thought was like you could refuse life sustaining treatment if you had a terminal illness. And basically, you could die from that, and you could refuse that, but you can't refuse psychiatric treatment, which is not terminal. You don't understand what I'm saying?
proven to shorten your lifespan by 25 to 30 years, right? So how that works, who is the person coordinating these strings to set up this scam of just a massive monopoly and strike against it's crimes against humanity as far as I'm concerned. But Anthony, I think that this is a good point to bring in Aubrey, who has been fighting and succeeding in Colorado around them wanting to end the jury trial.
Yeah, that's right. They were, and Colorado, sadly, is one of the last states that still has the jury trial, but legislation was introduced by Representative McCann of House District 8. Unfortunately, unlike in the national battle in Colorado, it's the Democratic Party that's coming for our rights instead of the Republicans with the Murphy bill. But they were trying to take the right to jury trial away from mental health certifications. Now, I fought this because personally, I had sought voluntary treatment about 2 years ago after I learned that these assholes, in order to force me into treatment when I was a kid, covered up child abuse, and they knew they were coercing a plea out of me when they did it when I was a juvenile. After I discovered that, I sort of, had trouble for the first time in my adult life, sought voluntary treatment. And since they didn't really have any slots, there was a 6-month waiting list at MHCD for voluntary treatment. They decided they'd certify me as gravely disabled to jump me up the line. And, of course, if they had released me, they would have kept me under certification. So I demanded a trial by jury, and the motherfuckers realized that they were going to lose. You never win in front of a judge. In front of a jury, anything can happen. So I was actually able to get out of their clutches. But we're actually learning that the jury trial revocation was attempted because the Denver City and County probate attorney had spoken to the legislators and said, look, if more people knew they had this right to trial by jury, we'd be screwed. The system would be overwhelmed. So it looks like what I'm learning is that I may have accidentally caused them to try and go after the jury trial because nobody used it. So we set up a massive robo-dialing campaign, contacted 33,000 constituents of Representative McCann and told them about the jury trial attack, which caused her to pull that bill. So they tried to introduce another bill, which had parts of the bill that removed the jury trial. The second bill didn't have the revocation of the jury trial, but it did remove the requirement dangerousness be imminent before they start a 72-hour hold, which, again, when they make the decision to place the hold, that's basically the only practical point at which somebody is or isn't certified. Once they take you in on the hold, you have two choices. You can do what they want, and they might let you go. Or you cannot do what they want, and they'll certify you, and unless you're prepared to basically fight it yourself in front of a jury, you're screwed. So for that bill, we actually had to communicate to the Second Amendment lobby how if people were getting locked up and committed more easily, they would also lose their firearms rights. And when the gun lobby understood that, they activated all of the Republicans to actually fight this bill, and it turns out that the bill was largely lost because they realized that they'd start to lose voters in an election year. The troublesome part of that is that they're going to try it again next year, which won't be an election year, but that's why I've launched the campaign to unelect Representative McCann. It's on Twitter at UnelectMcCann, or it's on Facebook, username UnelectMcCann. And what we're trying to do is actually incredibly difficult. She has 83% of the vote. It's a central Denver urban district that's primarily Democratic. But we're trying to make everyone aware that this representative came after the jury trial. If she did it for any other minority group, she'd be out of office immediately. So we're hoping to begin to send the message that coming after us is the same as coming after any minority group. And it turns out that stuff like this can't really be fought in the courts. No one in the legislature gives a damn if you write them as a constituent. What drives power in American politics is whether or not a certain action will get representatives unelected. So we're trying to send the message that coming after our people can get you unelected. And what we're trying to do is really inspire people to organize all over the place. Because if we can start to hurt people's polling figures, if they realize that instead of citing a tragedy here and a tragedy there on the news, which gets them a few kudos from people who don't really know anything, that coming after our people is something that could cost them elections, they'll think more carefully about it. And it's worth citing to people the statistic from the National Institutes of Mental Health. 26.2% of Americans have a diagnosable mental illness. And so as long as having a diagnosable mental illness is the criteria under the law, plus some claim they say of dangerousness, but we all know they'll construe anything as dangerousness, whether it's appropriate or not, and review by a judge doesn't mean anything. Review by a judge won't actually help you because they'll rubber stamp it if the evidence you're dangerous is First Amendment activities. The only real way to change this is to start to use power in the political process, and that means we have to start taking people out of office. If we could do that, we might be able to stem the tide. So it's an almost impossible goal with Representative McCann, but what we're trying to do is, A, cost her the election if we can, and if we can't do that, make her name synonymous with going after the jury trial rights of disabled people, specifically people with a mental illness, and let everybody know that if there are four of you standing together, one of your rights to the jury trial was attacked by this person, Representative Beth McCann. And so we're hoping everybody spreads the word everywhere. This is a person with ambition. This is a person who wants higher office. And everyone needs to remember, this is a person who was willing to come after our civil rights on pure bigotry. So that's really where we're at with the campaign now that we finished the bills. It's in a bit of a lull as we wait for the election to get closer. But we're trying to do everything we possibly can to start sending that message, the only message that matters. If you want to get elected, you cannot be an enemy of our people.
I think that, yeah.
I just want to interject really quickly. In New York State, with the AOT court hearing, there is no jury.
I was wondering what your perspective was going to be on this, and if that's how limited it is in New York that there isn't even that option, right?
You don't have the option to appeal to a circuit court or something.
I don't believe so. I'm not sure about that.
I'm not sure about that either, but it would be interesting to look into, because if it's just one of these things like that Aubrey, you know, was able to uncover in the path of trying to get out, then maybe it's something that we should be checking into to see that there isn't some loophole around a jury trial for people. Because, you know, when you watch these court hearings and you see the organization of it and how there's just a script, and that people aren't given any real opportunity, I wonder how different it would be if there was a jury trial.
Can anyone hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you.
This is Philip Mark Faber again. I called back in because I could not find you on Blog Talk Radio.
Listed. That's odd. It should be Talk with Tenney, but I'll check into that. Thanks.
Yeah, I just want to let you know. It's not on there.
Huh. That's interesting. Thank you. I will check in with them and figure out what's going on. But remarkably, people yet are finding us. So anyway. Thanks for letting me know that, Philip. And so I think that this issue, this legal, we're still on this legal stuff, Philip, so you might be interested in that.
Well, I mean, I'd just like to throw out there that one of the reasons Colorado was trying it, honestly, is because Colorado was one of the last states that preserved that right, and it wasn't very utilized in Colorado. So one thing that might be worth doing as a stopgap or an interim measure is if we can't get AOT completely outlawed, we might be able to make the point that whatever findings of fact are required in the law, regardless of how we feel about that, because it involves a deprivation of people's liberty, needs to be hearable by a jury. And that might be a political interim move. And again, the point is, with just the court, you're always fucked. So it's a mode of political attack as well, even if it's not a mode of legal attack on AOT laws.
Right. And all around is attacks. Anthony, would you like to share anything else tonight about why you wanted to call in or what you want people to know?
No, I think I touched on most of the issues I wanted to raise for tonight, though. But I definitely will call in at another time if I feel the need to.
Please do, and if you ever, you know, hopefully before then. But if you get any updates as to where you are, or if there is anything that you know, we can do to help bring awareness to what's going on, if that's needed, and then certainly afterwards, I look forward to working with you.
Okay, I'll keep in touch with you on Facebook. We talked on Facebook.
Yes. Okay, awesome. Thank you, Anthony.
Okay, have a good night.
Aubrey, you too. Aubrey, do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to add?
I mean, I guess in addition to what I said about organizing, what we really, really need is visibility. These decisions are not made via discussions about what's right and wrong. These decisions aren't even made about people thinking what they need. These decisions are made because a tragedy happens and there's a response. So what we really need to work on are the tragedies of state power inflicted on us being something the general public can resonate with. That will be part of making this a political bargaining chip, of making this a reality. In fact, I'd like to propose, I guess, as a final thought, that we throw together, we try to collect stories of people being harmed by AOT or commitment who are willing to speak up. And maybe we should set up a website and call it Preventable Tragedies and describe how these are tragedies that are carried out by the state use of power, and basically use Fuller Torrey's messaging, use Fuller Torrey's concept, and say, these preventable tragedies are the ones nobody's hearing about, and as a result, there's this massive, massive civil rights problem going on. I mean, I think we all need to start looking about that, start collecting that, see if we can make people understand, I guess is the best thought I've got.
And that continues to be our theme of how do you get people to understand this. And I think the conditioning techniques that are being used to associate fear with this idea that psychiatry has answers and is legitimate and that the use of force is legitimate in psychiatry is like one of the oldest tricks in psychological manipulation tactics, and if you couple things close enough together over and over again, people immediately will become, you know, that you can condition fear in people, and it's the fear that gets people to be able to be locked up and treated in these ways and have their human rights violated. I want to thank you. Does anybody else have any concluding thoughts? We have about 2 minutes left.
There's definitely something more to be said. I'm just not sure what it is. Do you know how many states have a similar statute like Oregon regarding the virtue of incarceration not being considered mental incompetence?
I don't know, but that would be interesting to find out. I do know that the involuntary outpatient commitment laws are in the overwhelming majority of states, and that the H.R. 3717 would mandate that they be in all states. And so I'm not sure it's exactly the same thing, but this idea that they're going to be able to quickly be able to have more and more of us drugged in under involuntary outpatient commitment laws is becoming more and more practical, and so stopping H.R. 3717 is really important. I do hope that we can continue this conversation, and I will be on for 2 hours a day, every day. Tomorrow may actually be at a different time, but I will be updating people and hopefully very soon coming to a set schedule of what that is. So I encourage you all to call back and to have other people who may be interested in calling call. If you have a specific idea for a show or would like to be a guest on Talk with Tenney, please get in touch with me at laurentenney@aol.com or facebook.com/TenneyLauren. Thanks for another great show. Signing off. Have a great night.